Hello, this is Barbara Ridenour with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated April 12th, 2019. We'll start today's reading on the front page with 13th District 2020 Campaign Starts Early. Londrigan announces rematch with Davis, Springfield. The 2020 campaign season is starting early for Central Illinois as Democrat Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan announced Thursday she plans to challenge U.S. Representative Rodney Davis again next year. Incumbent Davis, a Taylorville Republican, defeated Londrigan last fall by 2,058 ballots. He won 50.4% of the vote while she carried 49.6%. In announcing her candidacy among supporters at state AFL-CIO headquarters in Springfield, Londrigan focused heavily on health care, a theme of last year's campaign. She spoke about her own family's experience in 2009 when her son Jack, then 12, was battling a rare illness in pediatric intensive care. "I ran last year to protect all families, like mine, whose access to good care and insurance were the only thing standing between them and financial ruin or, God forbid, loss of a loved one because of an illness or medical emergency," she said. "I'm running for Congress in 2020 because we have unfinished business." A spokeswoman for Davis said voters rejected Londrigan in November because of liberal policies she supports. Democrats in the House are being pulled further and further to the left by their caucus, and Londrigan and everyone else running for Congress are going to need to tell voters where they stand, spokeswoman Ashley Phelps said in a statement. Londrigan is already on the record supporting Medicaid for all. She was endorsed by co-writers of the Green New Deal and has been supported by multiple candidates running for president. Londrigan last year fought back against Republican ads that characterized her as supporting a single-payer system, also known as Medicare for All. She has said she supports a public option that could compete with private insurance companies. Phelps last year pointed to a February 2018 candidate survey in which Londrigan said there are good options such as Medicare 10 and Medicaid for All being discussed, while calling for other solutions. The 2018 race was among the most watched in the country as both parties poured in funding and brought national attention to the district. Vice President Mike Pence visited Springfield to campaign for Davis, while U.S. Representative John Lewis, a Georgia congressman and civil rights icon, came to Decatur to campaign for Londrigan. Brian Gaines, a political science professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, said it's not extraordinarily unusual for someone to announce his or her candidacy so far ahead of an election. "It's not crazy to try and get your name out earlier," he said. "The only real advantage is trying to get a jump on other potential challengers to try to scare them out of the race. It's also a way for candidates to get the jump on fundraising in case of a strongly contested primary," according to Kent Redfield, a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Illinois in Springfield. Determining what issues the 13th congressional candidates will focus on, as well as predicting how people will vote, will likely depend on what national topics shape the election season, including health care, trade, and consensus regarding President Donald Trump. Gaines said that while it's far too early to tell, it might be harder for Democratic challengers to win some of the 2020 races due to the presidential and U.S. House of Representatives races sucking up donor funds. He said that because of this, Republicans like Davis might have an advantage in the election. Rodney Davis, having survived 2018, is by no means home free, Gaines said, but he's safer in 2020. Throughout last year's campaign, Davis touted the accomplishments of the Republican Party since Trump was elected in 2016, specifically tax reform and a national unemployment rate just under 4%. Londrigan said that she was motivated to join the race after Davis voted to support the GOP's American Health Care Act of 2017, which would have given states the authority to allow insurers to waive certain protections. specifically ones that prevents them, one that prevents them from charging higher premiums to those with health issues. On Thursday, Londrigan said she has continued to be disappointed by Davis's position on the issue. "It's long past time we had someone representing this community who has our best interests at heart," Londrigan said. "It's time we have a representative who meets constituents, whether they agree with her or not. It's time we had someone whose words are backed up by their actions and their votes." Londrigan had criticized Davis last year for not having open town hall meetings. Davis has said he regularly meets with constituents. Bruce Pillsbury, chairman of the Macon County Republican Party, declined to comment specifically on Londrigan's announcement, as he wasn't aware of it Thursday afternoon. However, he said that he wished her well in her attempts and commended Davis for being accessible and responsive to his constituents during his time in Congress. "He's worked his way up and has done very well for himself," Pillsbury said. "He does a wonderful job representing us." Macon County Democratic Party Chairman Jim Underwood did not respond to a request for comment Thursday. The Illinois Republican Party on Thursday tied Londrigan to what it described in a statement as the rapidly growing socialist wing of the Democratic Party. In a lame attempt to distance herself from the past statements and the Democratic Party's march toward socialism, Betsy Londrigan said she's absolutely not a socialist, but voters in the 13th District won't be fooled, Illinois Republican Party spokesman Aaron DeGroot said in a statement, adding that Londrigan should let voters know whether she would seek to impeach Trump, support the Green New Deal, Medicare for All, and a radical expansion of abortion. Londrigan told the State Journal Register in a story published Thursday that she is absolutely not a Democratic Socialist. The 13th District takes in parts the metro east outside of St. Louis and heads northeast to include Springfield, Decatur, and the Champaign-Urbana and Bloomington-Normal areas. Property talks smolder. Efforts to build new fire stations delayed. Decatur. While work continues on the new fire station on Decatur's north side, officials say lengthy land acquisition efforts have slowed progress on two others they hope to start building before construction season ends. Fire Chief Jeff Abbott said his department has found ideal locations for new facilities to replace Fire Station 3 at Fairview Park and Fire Station 7 at Decatur Airport, but negotiations with landowners to buy the parcels has taken longer than expected. "It's really proven to be quite challenging," Abbott said, adding that he expects talks to finish in the next few weeks. He declined to identify the exact locations being considered while negotiations are underway. Replacing the fire stations is part of an $8.5 million plan approved last year by city council members to build three new stations and renovate four existing ones. Funding comes from bonds, which will be paid back to the cost of about $400,000 a year for the next 20 years. Abbott said that the new stations will not only replace aging facilities, but will also help improve response times in their respective coverage areas. "We're trying to come up with the best land that we can within an affordable amount of money," he said. "It's not like we have an open checkbook to spend an exorbitant amount of money for this land." Work has already started on building a new Fire Station 5 at West Mound Road and Green Ridge Drive. It replaces a station at 225 Christine Drive, the northernmost fire facility in Decatur. Officials in January said delays have pushed their initial completion date for the $2.7 million station to April or May. Abbott said the challenging construction of that facility has motivated the department to move quickly and start building the two other new stations before the winter. That project was approved September 4th. The contractor was awarded the construction project, and it is now April, he said. "We still don't have a basement for that fire station. We've got to get into the construction season before the winter strikes." Fire Station Number 3 at 1308 West El Dorado Street was built in the 1920s near the entrance of Fairview Park, making it the oldest fire station in the city. The South Airport Road building that houses Fire Station 7 was built in the 1970s, Abbott said, and it is owned by the Decatur Park District. The latter station particularly is not as efficient as it could be because the response area to its east is mostly farmland, according to Abbott. We need to be able to respond back to the city of Decatur and run north and south in all areas of the lake and east of the lake in Decatur, he said. Abbott said the city still plans to build the two new stations at the same time with a similar design plan as a way to save money. He said once the land for the stations is acquired, the fire department will inform people living in the area and field questions from them as they did for the Fire Station 5 proposal. The Decatur City Council will also have to approve the land agreement and the construction bids for Stations 3 and 7. We're hoping to have council approval on bids by late May, maybe June, Abbott said. Decatur Fire Stations. The Fire Station 1 is at 1415 North Water Street. Fire Station 2, 2707 East Williams Street. Fire Station 3, 1308 West El Dorado Street. Fire Station 4, 2760 North 22nd Street. Current Fire Station Number 5 is at 225 Christine Drive. New Fire Station 5 will be at 3030 West Mound Road. Fire Station 6, 1880 South U.S. Business 51, and Fire Station 7, 1250 South Airport Road. See a map of all fire stations at herald-review.com. Local journalism. Herald and Review launches memberships. Readers like you are the heart of our business. You consume our journalism, visit our advertisers, and make us part of your day. We treasure the relationship. We need you, and we'd like to think you need us. That important connection is why we're introducing News Plus, a subscription model set to launch this month, built around the understanding that readers are more than just consumers, they're members. Our goal is to think differently about how our audience interacts with us. The mission? You give us your time and your money, and in return, we provide important journalism, keep you engaged with our work, and help you navigate life. We think that's a good start of a good partnership. And to get there, we're simplifying how we offer our content to you and boosting what you get back. It will work like this. Members will get news and information when they want and more of what they want in print, digital, or mobile, or some combination. We're making 5 different price levels based on what you get, with corresponding membership perks. All levels get unlimited access to the Herald and Review on any device, plus faster loading pages, starting with the digital basic package. But that's just the start. Other levels offer special promotions and access to other newspaper sites. The Platinum Package, for example, has all of those benefits, plus members-only email newsletters, free classified ads, 10 gift digital memberships, enhanced digital content like e-zines, among other advantages. There are lots of options to choose from, and you can learn more about those at herald-review.com/members. If you're an active subscriber, you're already a member. We're doing this for a few reasons. We know that strong media organizations build strong communities and that our newsroom offers comprehensive and award-winning news, sports, human interest, and entertainment coverage you can't get anywhere else. By creating levels, you can support local journalism in the manner that works best for you. We also get to showcase our expanding digital offerings, which goes well beyond our printed newspaper. Our digital channels provide instant breaking news updates on crime, weather, and traffic, plus the latest sports news. The Daily E-Edition is a digital replica of what that day's newspaper, which will be complemented by our new E-Edition Plus, with additional national, world, and sports news, plus lifestyle and other content. You'll be reading much more about our daily digital offerings on the front page of our newspaper. We're also rolling out many more reader engagement and community outreach events. Other membership perks include discounts on tickets to free 2-year access to thousands of historical articles, obituaries, and announcements through newspapers.com. We hope you join us. Your support means we have the resources to do important journalism. If you're already a member, tell your friends and family to follow your lead. Thanks for reading. This is by Michelle Pizar, and she's president and publisher of the Herald and Review and Central Illinois group publisher for Lee Enterprises, Incorporated. In local and state news on page A3, ADM announces restructuring. Company plans early retirements, possible job cuts. Archer Daniels Midland Company will be seeking voluntary early retirements and may eliminate individual jobs as part of a restructuring in part parts of the company, spokesperson Jackie Anderson confirmed in a statement. Anderson said the company is not sharing details but expects the number of workers affected to be a very small percentage of the total global workforce. It's unclear how many people might be affected, indicator, where Chicago-based ADM is the city's largest employer with more than 4,000 workers. Along with its North American headquarters, the company also has large corn and oil seeds processing operations, indicator. Anderson said employees were notified Wednesday that voluntary early retirement and streamlining of overlapping jobs and responsibilities following recent acquisitions would be among the actions taken by the company to trim its workforce. Beyond that, some individual jobs may be eliminated as part restructuring in specific areas of the company, she said. As much as possible, we will try to minimize individual impacts by finding suitable alternative opportunities within the company, Anderson said. These actions are necessary to strengthen the core of our business and establish ADM as a global leader in nutrition as we continue to grow and transform our business. As always, our priority throughout the process will be the respect and care of all employees impacted by these changes. ADM will release financial results for the first quarter of 2019 before the market opens on Friday, April 26th. The company reported fourth quarter 2018 profits on February 5th at $315 million, well below the $788 million it reported the prior year. The company has warned that flooding and severe winter weather in the U.S. Midwest would trim its first quarter operating profit $50 million to $60 million. Extreme winter weather has affected our first quarter North American operations beyond what we would experience in a typical winter, the company said in a statement released March 25th. ADM has about 32,000 employees worldwide, serving customers in more than 170 countries, including about 450 crop procurement locations, 270 food and feed ingredient manufacturing facilities, 46 innovation centers, and a global crop transportation network, according to the company. In December, ADM purchased the former Meta Pharmaceuticals manufacturing facility at 705 East El Dorado Street in Decatur. Anderson said at that time, ADM planned to use the facility to expand and develop our portfolio of specialty ingredients and products as we continue to grow that aspect of our business. Meta Pharmaceuticals has announced in March 2017 that it was closing its Decatur facility, which employed 90 people, and its operations wrapped up in June 2018. Saboteur enters diversion program. Mount Zion. Gage C. Hart, who had been facing felony charges for shutting down the Mount Zion School District's computer network while trying to sabotage a homework assignment, is now in an adult diversion program. The program means that charges against Hart, 19, have been dismissed and will stay that way as long as he pays required fees, restitution, completes 100 hours of community service, and stays out of trouble for 6 months. Macon County State's Attorney Jay Scott confirmed Thursday that Hart was placed in the diversion program. At a hearing in Macon County Circuit Court on Wednesday, three Class 4 felony charges of computer tampering were dismissed without prejudice, which means they could be filed again if Hart fails to complete the diversion program requirements. It was our idea he enter into the program, and it was decided with the concurrence of both the school district and the Mount Zion Police Department, Scott said. Mount Zion Police arrested Hart after he had launched disabling attacks on the school district's computer system November 20th, 26th, and 27th. Police said he used a phone app to overwhelm the school's computer system with information, shutting it down with what's typically called a distributed denial-of-service attack. The incident did not do any lasting damage, police said. The diversion program keeps somebody who made a really bad mistake in judgment from getting a felony conviction that will stick with him for the rest of their life, Scott said. Travis Roundcount, the school district superintendent, said Thursday that he could not comment about student situations publicly. House OK's bill on passing fines. Not stopping for buses could get more costly. Springfield. Drivers who don't stop for school buses could see a doubling in ticket fines under a proposed state law that passed the House on Thursday. House Bill 1873, sponsored by GOP Representative Darren Bailey of Xenia, doubles the fines for first offenses from $300 from $150, and for second offenses to $1,000 from $500. It passed the House on Thursday morning by a vote of 74-16, with 12 representatives voting present after extended and heated debate. Bailey called the bill a matter of public safety to protect school children as they load and unload off buses. Critics said increasing penalties don't deter people from violating the law and provide only extra hardship for those who have the least ability to pay them. Chicago Democrat Melissa Conyers Irvin said that was the first to voice opposition, saying she could not support the bill if the public is not educated about it simultaneously. Residents that can't pay it may lose their license, may in turn not be able to go to work, and may in turn not be able to put food on the tables for their children. There are people that will have no clue of this legislation, and all the bill will do is put them in a deeper hole, Conyers Irvin said. Bailey said he's willing to work with her on educating the public about the change in fine structure, because education is what will raise the awareness to protect our children. Others, like Jacksonville Republican C.D. Davidsmeyer, said a driver's first violation of the law should be enough education. HB 1873 changes only the fine structure for school bus violations. It does not change other provisions of current law for drivers to have their license suspended for 3 months for first violations and for a year for second violations. In those cases, drivers can apply to the Secretary of State's office for a restricted driver permit, which allows them to drive to and from work. Plainfield GOP Representative Mark Batnick, one of the bill's sponsors, said even with the doubled fines, Illinois laws for failing to stop for school buses are weak. I'm sitting over here stunned that we're putting the price tag to say an extra $150 is too much for a school kid, Batnick said. He referenced other states' penalties, some of which include jail time and fines as much as $10,000. Minnesota, he said, has a $500 fine and 90 days of jail time for the first offense. We're at the low end of the fines on this, which probably is why it keeps happening, because nobody cares about the fine, Batnick yelled. Bailey said Illinois schools bus drivers reported more than 20,000 instances where buses were passed while the stop arm was out in 2017, according to a survey by ABC7 in Chicago. Opponents maintain that doubling fines is regressive and that would result only in financial hurt for those who can't pay it. This bill is based on a flawed premise, said Democrat Will Guzzardi of Chicago. The idea is that by raising penalties on certain types of behaviors, we will deter those behaviors. Raising the fines isn't going to keep our kids any safer. It will just take more money out of the pockets of people that can at least afford it. HB 1873 was quickly placed on the Senate's calendar to be heard for its first time Friday. And the picture on this page today is Campus Preview Day. Richland College students Brandon Gann, left to right, Jerry Hodges, and Ashley Solano talked to parents and high school students about their experience during a student panel on Thursday at the Schilling Center. The panel was part of a Campus Preview Day for prospective students. In more state news, Senate okays bill to raise teacher salaries, Springfield. A second bill raising the minimum annual salary for Illinois teachers to $40,000 found legislative success this week. Senate Bill 10, sponsored by State Senator Andy Menar, Democrat of Bunker Hill, passed on a 45-11 vote Thursday afternoon. It would provide a five-year ramp to increasing Illinois minimum teacher salary from just more than $32,000 in 2021 to $40,000 in the year 2023 to 2024 school year. The substance of the legislation is the same as House Bill 2078, sponsored by State Representative Katie Stewart, Democrat of Edwardsville, that passed earlier this week. Menar's bill was approved, however, with an amendment the House version did not have, which directs a state review panel to figure out how Illinois' most underfunded school districts can get extra state aid to comply with the minimum salary law. Menar said that the state school funding formula must be slightly adjusted to make up the difference for the cost of the bill so that underfunded school districts could pay the minimum salaries. He said initial estimates are that just under $20 million would have to be added to the funding formula to help the neediest school districts comply with the law. According to SB 10's amendment, the professional review panel's recommendations must be made by January 31, 2020. Menar said an ideal timeline is that the recommendations are adopted in time for the governor's budget proposal in February 2020. When that budget passes in May of 2020, Menar said, the school funding formula will have already kicked out the extra money to underfunded school districts in time for the start of the school year's classes in August and September. We want to have a more level entry point for teachers across the state, Menar said of the proposed teacher salaries. Depending on where you teach, where you live, and which districts have openings, your entry level salary can fluctuate dramatically. A base rate would help reassure college students that when they graduate, they will have a decent wage. Proponents have also said a higher starting salary would help alleviate a teacher shortage across the state that has made it difficult for districts to fill open jobs. Opponents of SB 10 voice concerns similar to the bill's House counterpart. This is a significant underfunded mandate, State Senator Chuck Weaver, Republican of Peoria, said. School districts will be forced to lay people off. State Senator Kimberly Lightford, Maywood Democrat, emphasized that the salary increase to $40,000 was not immediate, but phased in over 4 years and still might not be enough. A $40,000 starting salary for a teacher is not a lot of money, she said Thursday, yet it would allow them the decency and respect to raise our generations to come. The state's current minimum teacher salary law of $10,000 has been unchanged since the 1980s. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, dated April 12, 2019. This is Barbara Ridenour, and please stay tuned.